Today we want to look at two of the visions, the night visions. There were eight altogether. We want to look at numbers 6 and 7 tonight. And the first one is the flying scroll vision. And then the next one is the 5-gallon barrel of trouble vision. And so they both have such interesting applications. And Zechariah is such a very interesting book of the Bible. We say that it is sometimes thought of like the book of Revelation in the New Testament. It's very visionary, very concerned with the end times. And so it's very much like the book of Revelation. And so today we're looking at some things that really do, once again, remind us of what we might have seen at the last book of the Bible, not toward the end of the Old Testament only. So we're looking at the flying scroll vision. You see from chapter 5, verse 1, I've provided the text for you. It says, then I turned and lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a flying roll. And he said unto me, what seest thou? I answered, I see a flying roll. The length thereof is 20 cubits, the breadth thereof 10 cubits. So to start out with, this is a scroll. We find that it is not an ordinary scroll because it's huge. The scroll unrolled, you know, if you make it one long page, it's 15 feet wide and 30 feet long. So there aren't any scrolls like that. And this scroll is extraordinary because it's flying. And we also notice that 15 by 30 is really interesting because those are the dimensions of the sanctuary, that is the holy place in Moses' tabernacle. So the Holy of Holies was a perfect cube, 15 by 15 by 15, but the sanctuary in the tabernacle was 15 by 30, and so we have a connection there. And look at this scroll, and that can't be an accident. We're being reminded of the holiness of God and the holiness of God's law, and this scroll has something to do with the holiness of God's law as indicated with the tabernacle and the giving of the law. Well, okay, so let's continue. Chapter 5, verse 3. Then said he unto me, this is the curse that goeth forth over the face of the whole earth. For everyone that stealeth shall be cut off, as on this side, according to it. And everyone that sweareth shall be cut off, as on that side, according to it. I will bring it forth, saith the Lord of hosts, and it shall enter into the house of the thief, and into the house of him that sweareth falsely by my name, and shall remain in the midst of his house, and shall consume it with the timber thereof and the stones thereof. All right, so if you look in those bulleted points, the scroll then is a curse scroll, and it's a judgment document. And we know that it has writing on both sides because Zechariah says this side and that side. So it's written on both sides. And in this judgment document, you see on one side is a judgment curse for all of the people who have been stealing. And on the other side of the scroll is a judgment curse for all of the people who have been swearing falsely by God's name. So they're dealing with two particular sins. You know that both of those can be found in the Ten Commandments tables because thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness. So we have two particular laws of the ten that are singled out here for the people of Israel in this curse vision. If you look at the second bullet down, we are taking for granted that when the Lord says this scroll will enter somebody's house and it will ruin the timbers of the house, not just the household, but actually the timbers of the house, it will ruin the timbers of the house, and there will be judgment because of what they've done wrong, stealing, swearing falsely. We take for granted that that is not literal. That is, when the house is being judged, you're not going to see a scroll 15 by 30 entering into the front door and staying in the house until the whole thing goes to pieces. We don't think that the scroll is visible, that it's going to be something that tangibly flies into your window and you look at it and say, oh, this scroll is in here. But just because a thing is not visible doesn't mean that it's not real, that it's not a very particular kind of judgment. The judgment is going to enter the house, and it's a very real judgment. So even though you don't see it, in a sense, you can say, even though you don't see it, it still is literally a curse that enters that house and brings both judgment on the people who dwell there and actually on the property. Remember that, because the thing is invisible, that doesn't mean that it's not real. So we're reading in the book of Revelation that Satan is going to be bound with a chain and cast into hell. You think, well, what kind of a chain could bind an invisible devil? You know, how would you wrap the devil with a chain? And of course, it couldn't be a literal iron chain like we think of a chain. But just because it's not something you can see and touch, it doesn't mean that it's not real in a very identifiable sense. So it is a chain. It's not an iron chain, but it's a chain that one day if you had eyes to see, you'd say, yep, that's a chain. I get it. That's a chain. And so it is with this scroll. Not that people will actually see it enter their house, but that there is a reality about it. You think, ooh, the curse has entered this house, and the effects of that curse are all around me. So I think the Lord is singling out families, their particular properties, and he's bringing a curse on those people because they have stolen or because they have witnessed falsely, using the Lord's name to give credibility. Well, the third bullet down then brings up this lesson of the scroll. You notice that both of the sides of the scroll are addressing integrity. So a person who steals is someone who is not acting out of integrity. And on the other side of the scroll, the person who swears falsely by God's name, in popular language we'd say, I swear to God I did such and such a thing, and it's not true. I swear to God that this is a good product that I'm selling you, and it's not true. You've used God's name to give credibility to what you're saying, and you've used it falsely, and you've known it. So you see that that's an integrity problem. Stealing is an integrity problem, and swearing falsely by God's name is an integrity problem. So the lesson of the scrolls you see there in the third bulleted point. Personal integrity is non-negotiable with God. For the Lord to threaten to cut off, because that's what he says, the person who steals will be cut off, as on this side of the scroll it reads. In Isaiah 53, when we're describing the sufferings of Jesus, it says he'll be cut off out of the land of the living. So sometimes cut off means killed. Sometimes cut off means you're banished from the land of Israel. And it's hard to tell in certain contexts which is intended. But in this context, we think we know, because it says that the scroll of judgment enters into the house of the person that swears falsely and remains in the midst of the house and consumes it with the timber thereof and the stones thereof. It sounds like this person is going to be in a bad way. The house is crumbling. It sounds like he might be committing a capital crime and there's going to be an execution. At any rate, for the Lord to threaten to cut off the people who steal or to cut off the people who swear falsely by his name, integrity must be a major priority in his plan for his children. God wants his people to be people of integrity. And if we are not people of integrity, then that must be a major failure and not a minor one in the eyes of God as he looks down on his family. So we want to talk about integrity for a few minutes here, being truly honest. So this whole vision is on the subject of integrity, stealing and swearing falsely by God's name. How is it likely in your life for you that you will be tempted to compromise on your integrity? Where do these things happen? If we get bitten by a temptation in the area of integrity, from what direction will it come? What do you think? When is it hard to deal with integrity with other people, the people around you? When is it difficult? Give me some ideas. I know, particularly when I was younger, I agonized when I was selling a car over what to say and what not to say. You never know. You know, what are your obligations? When you sell a car, do you have to tell the person everything that has ever gone wrong with it? I hate buying and selling cars. It scares me. I don't mind buying them so much. I hate selling them because I don't want somebody to think I'm a crook. And it hurts me to think that somebody is going to drive my car and then they're just going to hate it because there was something wrong with it. That always bothers me. So I have always found it's very hard to guard integrity when you're selling something of value. That's when it's hard for me. When else is integrity a difficult thing in your life? Filling out your tax form. Yes, it's hard to deal with integrity when you're doing taxes. Good. What else? Keeping your word in general, and if I can add on what Nancy is saying, particularly keeping your word to people who are relying on you. You know, it's one thing when we're speaking offhandedly. I was at a Gideon's event a whole year ago, and a pastor friend saw me there, and he said, "You know what? I'm going to get together with you for lunch sometime. We need to get together." I said, "Sure, that would be great." And he's never called me. But even while we were saying that, I thought, well, you know, you're a pretty busy guy, and, you know, if you don't get around to calling me, it's okay. It's not going to hurt my feelings. I'm fine. And I really don't care. You know, that's fine. Yeah, whatever. I've been glad to get together with him, and I really don't mind that he got busy and never called me. But there are certain people in life who are relying on you. So when you have given somebody the impression that you're going to do something and they're relying on you for that, it's very important to follow through. When somebody, you know, there are certain people who, when they see you, you are their hope, you know? Like, I didn't think there was going to be any help, but now I think because this guy knows the situation, there's going to be help. And he said that he might be able to help me. And so you've given this person hope that a certain thing might come to pass. Then you really have to follow through on that. There's like a social contract. And if somebody has given you the impression that they're relying on you, that they're depending on you, then you really have to follow through. And while we all make mistakes, you know, Nancy mentions, I was going to call somebody and I didn't get to it and all of that. And that's fine. I mean, we all do things like that. But if somebody is relying on you, you really have to follow through. You have to help this person because there has been an understanding. You've led that person on to believe that a particular thing is so. So you have to make it so. That's an issue of integrity at some point. Not that every word you say offhandedly is a binding commitment. But if you think that somebody is relying on you, then you don't want to let them down. That's just part of a trust that you don't want to betray. When else is integrity difficult? Joe? Yes. Yeah, so people are relying on you for, you know, meeting at a particular time and place. You want to follow through on that. Shannon? Good. Yes. So Shannon is talking about taking ownership for what you've done that is wrong and not downplaying it if it's your fault, and exaggerating the faults of others at the same time so that we all come out in the wash. You have to confess your sins, you know, acknowledge that you've been out of line, and that's just part of integrity. So, yeah, absolutely. Of course, money is a big thing. Make sure that you are not somehow taking money away from somebody, hindering somebody's commission. If it's a commission situation, somehow treating an employer in a way that does not reflect integrity. You know, my boss thought he was getting a superstar, and what he really ends up getting is somebody who's loafing, looking to dodge all the responsibilities. And you know, that's just not That's not a way of dealing with your boss that has integrity. You should be able to say, I'm going to give you good value for your dollar if you hire me. And then you got to do that. You know, don't steal from the company by saying, I'm going to kick back and take it easy. You thought you're hiring a superstar, and as much as possible, I'm going to be your superstar. I'm going to work very hard for you. And that's just dealing with integrity. While I'm here, I'm all the way here. And so in all of these ways, the Lord wants his people to be people of integrity. Don't cost anybody any money. If it comes to choices, make sure the other person comes out ahead when it comes to money. Don't make it costly for another person to be your friend. They should come out ahead if they're your friend. Ahead financially, ahead with time investment and favors and all those things. Make sure that the other guy comes out ahead, because you don't want them to think that you have been sponging, leeching off of them. You want them to know that you are honest and above board in all these things. Nancy. Yeah, well, curse is a pretty hard word to apply to New Testament saints. But it's not totally out of line. So those fellows in 1 Corinthians 11 who are getting sick and dying because they have disrespected the communion supper, that's pretty similar to what we have here. And of course, in that case, it would be permanent if they died. Yeah, sometimes people say, I don't want to think that God is sending anything negative. We're just reaping the consequences. You know, so if I am going to take drugs, I might get AIDS or hepatitis from the needles. So it's not like God sent AIDS or hepatitis to me. It's that if you take drugs shooting needles, you might get drugs and hepatitis. That's just the consequence of what you're doing. Well, that's true. There is a consequence, and that's fine. But beyond all of that, you know, natural consequences business, those fellows who got sick and died in the Corinthian church because they were dishonoring the communion supper, it is not a natural consequence of eating till you're full that you would die from that. Almost all of us eat until we're full pretty often, but we don't die from it. But in 1 Corinthians, it says they were eating till they were full, and their neighbor next to them doesn't have enough, and they don't even think to share. And then beyond that, they were getting drunk on the communion wine. And normally, getting a little buzzed on the communion wine, or on any wine, does not lead to death, but it did to them. So that's not a consequence of having a little bit too much wine. That's the Lord sending death to them. So, you know, I don't know that we would want to say that those fellows in 1 Corinthians 11 have been cursed, but it's not that big of a difference. A curse is a judgment sent by God, so what's the big difference? You could probably say they were cursed if you want to, but I don't think that term is used in the New Testament for Christians, as far as I know. So maybe that's not the best term. But the idea is not so dissimilar. Good. All right. So if you turn this page over, we want to do the 5-gallon barrel of trouble. This is night vision number 7. We pick up the story, chapter 5, verse 5. Then the angel that talked with me went forth and said unto me, lift up now thine eyes and see what is this that goes forth. And I said, what is it? And he said, this is an ephah that goeth forth. He said, moreover, this is their resemblance through all the earth. And behold, there was lifted up a talent of lead. And this is a woman that sits in the midst of the ephah. All right, so just stop there for a minute. An ephah is equal to about 5 gallons. It could have been 5 gallons in a basket. It could have been 5 gallons in a ceramic jar. Could be 5 gallons in a wooden barrel type of arrangement. It doesn't matter. About 5 gallons, however, it's packaged. And the angel that speaks to Zechariah says, and we think, by the way, that this is Christ emceeing all of these visions. He says, this is their resemblance throughout all the earth. So we find this kind of thing everywhere. So, okay. And we find out that this thing that's just everywhere in the earth is wickedness. And that comes in the next part of the text. But for now, look at the second bullet point. It says there's a lead lid. And it weighs a talent. Talent, that's a little sketchy. About 75 to 100 pounds, we're not sure. So there's this lead lid on the barrel. It weighs about 75 pounds. And it's lifted up in the vision so Zechariah can see what's inside the 5-gallon barrel. He looks inside, and there's a woman. And she's not good. Verse 8 says this is wickedness. So there's a woman in this barrel, probably kind of a sketchy, seductive-looking woman, and she's in the barrel. We're noticing here that, no, a woman could never fit in a 5-gallon barrel. We understand that this is a vision, so just work with us here. And then you come to verse 8. And he said, this would be the MC, Christ. He said, this is wickedness, pointing at the woman, you know, the contents of the barrel. And he cast it into the midst of the ephah. So he might have like reached in and picked her up a little. This is wickedness, and threw her back into the barrel. And then he cast the weight of lead upon the mouth of the barrel to lock her in. So she's in the 5-gallon barrel. You see, the woman in the barrel, bulleted point, was representative of all that was wicked in the world, because that's what it says. This is a resemblance of what we find everywhere in the world. It's everywhere around us. Particularly, though, this would be the thing you'd find in Babylon, which has now become absorbed into the Persian Empire. And Babylon, Persia, has always been a very wicked place. That was the epicenter of idolatry from the days of the Tower of Babel, Babylon, and Nimrod, the first human who was worshipped as a god. And so this wickedness is everywhere, but especially this wickedness is in Babylon, Persia. And so God locks the woman in the barrel with this heavy lid, and now she's ready to be shipped, prepared for packing. And we pick up the story in verse 9 then. Then lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, there came out two women, and the wind was in their wings, for they had wings like the wings of a stork. And they lifted up the ephah between the earth and the heaven. Then said I to the angel that talked with me, where do these bear the ephah? Where are they carrying it? And he said unto me, to build a house in the land of Shinar, and it shall be established and set there upon her own base. All right, so this is the way the vision ends. You see, in the first bulleted point, we're going to try to identify who these creatures are that pick up the barrel, one on each side, and carry it to Shinar. Since birds symbolize demonic activity in certain important contexts of Scripture, we are imagining, and additionally, storks are unclean birds, and these women have wings like storks. We think that these should be identified as demonic creatures. And you see the hollow bullet there. While angels are often depicted in popular art and lore as women with wings, this is the only place in the Bible where women with wings are described, and these are probably demons because they're stork wings. These are probably demons, not good angels. And all biblical angels are males, and the only angelic creatures that have wings, good angels, are cherubs and seraphs. The rest don't have wings. Whenever you see angels appearing in Scripture, they're called young men. That's what they look like. If they're a special class of angels like the seraphs and the cherubs, that's different. They can have wings, and they don't look very human. But normally, an angel should look human and male. They're always called young men. So who are these females with stork wings? We think that they're demons. The second bullet down. The two demonic women in the vision carry the wicked woman in the barrel out of the Holy Land where she does not belong, because remember, all the captives are coming back, and this is a time for Zechariah to encourage them. We've talked about Zerubbabel being the governor of all those who came back, and Joshua the high priest in Jerusalem for all those who came back. So this is a Jerusalem vision, and we don't want this woman in Jerusalem. Take her away. So the two demonic women in the vision carried the wicked woman in the barrel out of the Holy Land where she does not belong, back to Babylon, Shinar, where she did belong. So Shinar is Babylon. We're going to get her out of here. And you see the next bullet, the wicked woman would then prosper and settle into her own new house there in Shinar, because the text says they're going to build a house in the land of Shinar, and this woman in the barrel shall be established and set there upon her own base. So she's going to set up headquarters in Babylon, and that's where she belongs. So the woman is now going to have her own new house, new chapter there in Shinar. She'll be established. While Babylon has always been the epicenter of evil in the Old Testament world, you read there, there probably is a layer of meaning here for Revelation 17 and 18 in the future as well, where mystery Babylon the Great is judged. And so Babylon, the literal Babylon there in the area of the Persian Gulf where the Tigris and Euphrates split off, that's always been a problem in all of biblical history. That's always been a problem. And so this woman is sent back there where she belongs, and she'll be established there and grow and prosper. And the last bullet there tells us something about the lessons to be gleaned from this. The lesson of the barrel of the trouble. Zechariah's message here would remind the Jewish ex-captives, because they've come back to the Holy Land, right? So not captives anymore. They're ex-captives back in the land. Would remind them to leave their sin-tainted Babylonian attitudes and behaviors behind, to be thoroughly committed to their God. In other words, the Lord packed up that trouble and sent it out of there. We don't want it around here. All of that Babylonian influence that might have crept back in with the captives, let's ship it out. We don't want it here. And so it's shipped out. And of course, we have always in our lives some packages to ship out too. Like them I have in the hollow bullet. We have to reject the anti-God attitudes and behaviors that surround us where we live. Like Hollywood, Wall Street, Washington lifestyles of immodesty and covetousness. About such things we should say, this is wickedness, and we should send them packing. So it's really interesting that the Lord wants his people to be pure. All the Babylonian influence, the toxicity that they might have brought back with them to the Holy Land, Zechariah is saying, we have to do away with this. This is wickedness. Slam the lid on it and get it out of here. Carry it back where it belongs. It doesn't belong with us. So how about if we talk about that for a few minutes? How are we likely to be tainted by Babylon, here where we live? Where is the danger for you and me in being tainted by the world around us? What's going to give you a hard time? What's going to give your loved ones, the new Christians that you're working with, your own children, what's going to give them a hard time? How are we going to have to help them purge themselves from the Babylonian influences? Where are those influences? What are we on guard for, Josiah? Yeah, so Josiah's talking about materialism and getting the next thing. We want stuff, and we honestly think that this stuff is going to make us happy. And it's hard to quit thinking that way. So yes, materialism's a big deal, and that's, you know, that's Babylon around us. We have to think, if I was on that show, Little House on the Prairie, and I had this little one-room house, could I be happy with that? Do I honestly think that my soul is pure enough to be happy with that? Or would I resent it and hate it? And hopefully the answer is, no, I'm okay with that. I would do that. That doesn't scare me. But it takes some grit, some spiritual grit, to say, no, I would truly be okay with that. And I hope you have that grit and always keep it. How else will we be tested? Jim. If you can hear Jim, he's talking about the stories in a culture. So particularly our entertainment, television, movies, what you read, what you're seeing on the computer. Stories, because they're very persuasive. And you can argue with somebody a lot of times about various academic points, and they don't have any trouble resisting that. But when you tell them a story that's crafted in a very clever way, they may cave in to the point of the story, even though it's anti-Christian. So be careful what you choose for entertainment, what stories you choose to listen to, and particularly for your loved ones that you have some influence over, you have to protect them as well. Good. Mike, you actually become glad that you're unteachable. You know, I hate being teachable. I am independent. So, yeah, that's awful. Good point. Amy. Yeah. Yeah, the seductiveness of fame. Yeah, we crave attention and we want the fringe benefits that go with attention. Yeah. You know, in the world of politics, we have always divided into conservatives and liberals. And then more recently, the conservatives have divided into social conservatives and fiscal conservatives. And a lot of conservatives have given up on the social agenda, that is conservative family values, you know, no homosexual marriage, no abortion. They've given up on those things and said, well, at least we can still all agree on being fiscally conservative. But the real irony in that is that almost all of the issues that we're talking about come down to family values, sexuality. So, for example, at this very moment, the census takers tell us that the average American household is 1.5 people. Well, you know that means that there are a bunch of people who are living by themselves. And some experts have said the reason we are 1.5 people per household is because we don't get along with people well enough to keep relationships intact. And so we're not two people living together long enough to even count as two people per household. The marriages break up. The kids scatter and move away. So we don't get along with anybody very well. Well, then on top of that, you know, we have sociopathy as a norm. We have all this ridiculous input on, well, you don't need to be married if you're going to live together. That's all right. You don't need to be married. If you are married, you can shake that off and quit being married. Maybe the kids won't live with you anymore if there's a divorce. But you realize that all of that is sex-driven. I mean, everything we're saying is that you don't have to be married to enjoy that intimacy. You don't have to be. And so, you know, that affects your finances. So suddenly now you say, I thought we were talking about fiscal conservatism. And now you're back on social conservatism. They are all tangled together. They're interwoven. So if you will not get married and stay married, there are going to be financial repercussions. If you're going to move from person to person, you're probably going to keep starting over, and you never then have any financial stability. But we're not just talking about fiscal stability then, we're talking about social conservatism. And they're all related. So, you know, why do we have to have so many abortions? Because I can't afford to raise those kids. There's no way I can raise those kids. I'm not married. How can I raise those kids? So abortion is related to money. And divorce is related to money. And homosexual marriage, what is that all about? They want financial benefits that come when one or the other dies. Insurance policies that cost money. That's money. So you say, well, no, I don't want to talk about social conservatism. I want to talk about fiscal financial conservatism. And we're going to step back and say, it's all one. That they're inextricably bound together. It's one issue. And so what we're really talking about is the dismantling of America over the issue of sex. That's what it comes to. And that's just, it's just awful. But that's what you have to resist. You have to say no to a household of 1.5 people. You have to say no to the impression that, well, you don't have to be married to enjoy that intimacy. You have to say no to those things because, you know, that's wickedness. Put it in the barrel, slam the lid on it, and ship it out. You know, I mean, you can't do that politically, but you have to do that in your personal life. And it is important that you, you know, connect the dots, because wickedness is a bad thing, and it touches everything, and the dominoes fall. And so there we are. Well, our time is up, but you see then the two big lessons. In this hand, the lesson of the flying scroll, the Lord wants us to be people of integrity, and he really seems to get aggravated if we are not dealing with the people next to us with integrity. In this hand, the Lord wants us to ship the wickedness away. Let Babylon do whatever it's going to do. That has nothing to do with us. What hath Babylon to do with Jerusalem? We're in Jerusalem. Ship that stuff back to Babylon where it belongs and keep it out of here. In your own life, that has to be your attitude.